General Menezes, Reel 1. Can you tell me when and where you were born, General?
I was born in the suburb of Santa Cruz of Bombay on 13 November 1922.
And could you tell us a little about your family background? Give us an idea of the kind of family you were brought up in and your experience.
My father was an engineer. He'd spent 14 years in Britain. He'd become a professional student virtually, engineering student. He'd acquired 3 degrees and 2 engineering diplomas from universities like Edinburgh, Leeds and Dublin. He applied for a commission at the beginning of World War I, having spent 14 years in Britain, possibly most of his time at Speaker's Corner in Hyde Park. But the British government said they were not commissioning Indians except in the Army Medical Corps. But since he'd volunteered for war service, they sent him to Mesopotamia as a civil engineer, where he worked on the railway, construction of the railway to Baghdad. There he became a great admirer of General Stanley Maude. And in a way, my name Stanley is after General Maude. Of course, he was convinced that General Maude had been murdered by his own troops or his own staff by putting arsenic into his drink. Nevertheless, at the end of the war, he was given what was called a war reserve vacancy in the then Bombay Presidency as an executive engineer in the Public Works Department. And so he was engaged in the construction of what is now the Bombay International Airport at Santa Cruz, but at that time was going to be known as the Santa Cruz Airport. He was engaged in construction of that when I was born. When he had come to England, he'd come with a maternal uncle of mine. Both had been classmates in St. Patrick's School, Karachi. And my maternal uncle went on to, had come here for the Indian Civil Service examination, but after reading law and being called to the bar at Gray's Inn, he opted for the Colonial Civil Service. And they used to exchange notes, my father in Bombay, my uncle in the then Malaya. And by and large, they came to the conclusion that the British officers or officials who were posted above them were less qualified and less educated than they were. So in 1927, both decided to resign.
Was it a comfortable childhood you had in Santa Cruz?
No, in the sense that when my father decided to resign, my mother walked out with the 2 children. And it then became an argument between the two. She said he would only come back when he took a full-time government employment or whatever. He was doing part-time engineering work with firms like Richardson and Curtis, private sector firms. But he taking the stand that she first came back before he would take up any long-term employment. So this battle of wills took place, and we were at that point of time when she left my father, she joined her mother, who had been in Simla but had just moved to Delhi, along with another one of my maternal uncles. So from that point of view, I saw very little of my father thereafter, because the two would not come to any compromise on this issue.
So you went to live in Delhi?
So I was in Delhi, but I was put into boarding school in Mussoorie.
Mussoorie?
Mussoorie, a hill station called Mussoorie. Initially in a convent run by what were called the Jesus and Mary nuns. At that time, it was a boys' school. Today, of course, it is a girls' school. But then thereafter, when I reached a particular age, I had to go to another school, so I was transferred to a school called St. George's, run by the Irish Patrician brothers.
Also in Missouri?
Also in Missouri.
Could you give us an idea of what your education was like in the boarding school? You know, what kind of teaching methods, what kind of life you had?
It was very good. The ethos of these schools was superlative. The education was very high quality. And their care and regard for us Indians, by and large, educational missionaries who had foregone all their family contacts in order to educate us, was something that cannot be described today.
How would you describe the ethos of the school? So,
as I said, it was superlative in the sense, it was educationally very high standard. And in both schools, in all competitions, we came first.
And did you specialise in any particular subject or have any particular...
No, in between, my uncle, who by that time, the colonial civil service uncle, he settled in France because he had a French wife. He felt that I should acquire some European languages. So in a gap year, I spent in Florence learning Italian and French in 1933. But then the Simon Laval sanctions were then imposed on Mussolini for his threats to Abyssinia. So my mother panicked and I was withdrawn back to India. Of course, the idea was still that I would sit for the Indian Civil Service examination as I came of age, but now without any European languages, but instead with an Indian language and a dead European language that would give me high marks to qualify for the Indian Civil Service examination. So I took up Latin and Urdu for the first time in 1934. And nevertheless, I did scholastically do well in what was then the United Provinces for what was called the Junior Cambridge. I came sixth in the UP in the United Provinces. And in the senior Cambridge, I came second in the UP. And the examination was conducted by a syndicate at Cambridge, which still exists in a different form. I think it's called OCA now or something of that nature. But it was a marvelous syndicate in the sense it conducted examinations, secondary school examinations for the whole British Empire. And I cannot praise the standard sufficiently, both from the point of view of the syllabus as well as from the point of view of the examinations, unlike what you see here today.
So what happened next then? You got these qualifications.
No, I then, as I say, did my senior Cambridge examination, and then I had the choice of going to the plains to join university or carry on for what was called the intermediate arts or intermediate science examination. So in 1938, I joined what was called in the same college, St. George's College, Missouri. I joined the intermediate arts class, and that covered the first year of university. Thereafter, I had to go to the plains. Again, I came second in the province in the examination, getting a scholarship each time. And the scholarship was sufficient to pay for my education. But then, thereafter, it was a question of doing what was called my second and third year in a university in the plains. Now, here the hitch that occurred. My mother did not want to surrender the scholarship because the scholarship was worth 45 rupees a month at that point of time, which was quite a lot of money. And by a delay in getting a decision that the United Provinces government would not transfer the scholarship to either Delhi or Bombay. They said I had to avail of it only if I took up my college education in the United Provinces. So that period of time, the best that could be managed was an admission to a college called St. John's College at Agra, run by the Cambridge Mission. All the academics were again missionary educationists who had qualified at Cambridge. And in India at that point of time you had these two missions. One was Cambridge Mission and one was Oxford Mission. Both were academics who had qualified at the respective Oxford universities and had decided to dedicate their life to missionary work, in the sense that by setting an example, they hoped that Indians would rally to the cause. So I then completed my, graduated, was awarded my degree.
What was your degree? What subject did you take at St. John's College?
I took English Literature, Economics and Applied Mathematics. The higher Applied Mathematics I took for the circumstance of marks. English Literature also I was good at, and marks, but they would not, I did not offer the, I did not like the grouping of philosophy, so I took economics instead. But after graduating, I was still waiting for the Indian Civil Service examination for my age group, and I decided to do my MA in higher mathematics, because it was, I felt pursuing economics did not give me good marks. In the event, the then government announced that they had cancelled in 1942, after I graduated and I was in my fifth year, that is my doing my MA, they announced that they'd already cancelled the ICS examination in Britain and they were now cancelling it in India. And that if I wanted to join the civil service, I could join the armed forces and thereafter taking up a war reserve vacancy in the civil services after the war. That's how I came to be in the army.
So that was in September 1942, and you went to the officers' training?
I went to the officers' training school.
Now, between September 42 and May 43, you attended the officers' training school as a cadet at Lahore and then Bangalore. Could you tell us a little bit about the setup of the officers' training school, who it was for and how it worked, and then we'll look at your time there in a bit more detail, what you actually studied.
It was, these schools were intended as, shall we say, officer cadet training for Indians and British, shall we say, cadets. Lahore was an addendum that had been made because it was felt that Indians needed a bit more training than their counterparts who were British cadets, because the British cadets were already conscripts and had a military background.
So it was where you got your basic training, military training?
Yes, except that they differentiated between the Indian from the Indians from the ranks, who were also made to do the same training as us at Lahore, on the grounds or plea that their English needed improvement. Yeah. So after this experiment of 2 months at Lahore, they decided to concentrate all the 8 months at Bangalore. So we were the last course at Officers Training School, Lahore.
Now, tell me about the training you actually got at Lahore in this first part then. What exactly training was it? Could you go through it as much detail as you remember?
Well, Lahore was, shall we say, you may say, as far as we were concerned, basic recruit training, in the sense that drill, weapon training, firing.
Let's go through these things. How did you take to basic drill, foot drill?
I did. I took it well because, after all, in boarding school we were already doing it.
And did you understand then the point of drill? If you could tell us, you know, I mean, why you...
Well, I did understand because it disciplined the system and ensured coordination.
And what about weapons training? Can you tell us a little about the weapons you were introduced to and how they actually trained you?
In this initial 2 months, we were introduced only to the rifle and firing on the short range.
That would be the Lee Enfield?
Yes, what was called the SMLE, short magazine, Lee Enfield Mark III.
And do you remember how they actually taught you, the actual process they took you through from, you know, from start to finish?
Well, the basic grounding was in aiming, and thereafter in firing on the short range.
How did you take to it? Were you a good shot?
Yes, I was a good shot. I mean, subsequently in my career, I'll come to that later, when I was a battalion commander.
Okay. So, anything else about basic training? Any other elements to it?
No, I would say that it was what you would call basic recruit training. But it was basic training for officer cadets. The only thing was that the people from the Indians from the ranks were going through the same training as us Indian civilians. And so we had to compete with them, but there was no difficulty.
How did you get? Could you talk a bit about the cadets? What sort of origins they came from? Generally the people from the ranks, and then the civilians like yourself. Just a little about what they were like.
Well, the civilians were all academically mostly graduates, but on account of all the Indian civil service examinations having been discontinued, the armed forces became, shall we say, the focus of government employment at that particular period, because you could not get a permanent appointment in any Indian government service without going through the armed forces at that particular point of time. The only thing is that when I did go for my interview to what was called the Federal Public Service Commission, they did feel that I should go to the Navy, that I was too educated for the Army. I could hear them whispering amongst themselves that I look too much of a gentleman to go to the Army and that I should go to the Navy. So I did go to Bombay. They gave me a so-called entrance paper, written test to the Navy. Then they gave me a medical test, and using some Japanese test, they said I was colorblind. So I was then offered back. So I was then offered to the Air Force, where they looked at my papers. I didn't go to any interview with the Air Force, but they looked at my papers and said if I was colorblind for the Navy, I would be colorblind for the Air Force as a pilot also. So I went back to the Army, which was my original choice, because when in the application they had three spaces for your options: Army, Navy, or Air Force. And I'd written Army, Army, Army. So I had been sent to the Navy at their behest, not at mine.
And how did you get on with the other cadets on a personal level?
I got on well enough. There was no difficulty about getting on, because in any case, some of them were graduates like myself. The Indian cadets from the ranks, who were by and large, you see, if you go back to Lord Kitchener's days, he didn't want any babus as officers. He always distrusted educated Indians, and he preferred to give commissions to the progeny of people who had served the British already in the armed forces. That was his philosophy.
Now, that was obviously breaking down at this time, then, if there were, you know,
in terms of what were called the Montague Chelmsford reforms. Montague, who was Secretary of State at that particular point of time, was a very far-seeing gentleman. So when he'd come out to India in 1917, I mean, presumably, I don't wish to say so, but I mean, I must say so, presumably because he was a Jew, he himself felt that discrimination must be avoided. He wrote a brilliant book about his visit to India at that particular point of time, Edwin Montague. And India owes a lot to him for his opening up the various services to Indians.
And so he encouraged educated Indians to apply?
Yes, he wanted them. Otherwise, up to 1917, the British officers, military officers, were only wanting to commission people from the ranks. But then they eventually did realize that they did not have the education to look further. As also, their English could not now be improved, and they were rigid in their ways. Shall we say the first batch of Indians commissioned in the regular Indian Army were all people who were Viceroy's commissioned officers. When the British initially had raised the what they called the native battalions of the then East India Company Army, you had a British commandant and what was called an Indian commandant. And later, after 1858, they were called Viceroy's Commissioned Officers. Not King's Commissioned Officers, but Viceroy's Commissioned Officers. So, by sleight of hand, when the British military hierarchy were asked to commission Indians, they chose to commission people whom they could trust, that is, these Viceroy's Commissioned Officers. But nevertheless, Montague overrode them, and the Indians were then eligible to apply for Sandhurst. And initially it was felt that the rejection rate of Indians at Sandhurst was quite high. So therefore, an institution called the King George's military schools were opened up for the sons of Indians serving in the armed forces to educate them to, shall we say, what was called the Indian Army Special. It would qualify them, shall we say, equivalent to the senior Cambridge on the or the matriculation on the civil side, as also to open up what was called the Prince of Wales Royal Indian Military College at Dehradun. This was inaugurated by the then Prince of Wales when he visited India in 1921. This was to enable boys, instead of going to boarding school, they would compete for vacancies at this Prince of Wales Royal Indian Military College at Dehradun, and thereby acquire some gloss and veneer to qualify themselves as officers in the Indian Armed Forces.
Now, what about the instructors? Who were the instructors at, at Lahore? Who was actually doing the basic training? Who was taking you?
The commandant at Lahore was a major from the Royal Army Education Corps, a Major Humphreys. Our particular company commander was a Captain Letchworth, British officer of the Indian Army. And our sergeant major was a sergeant major, company sergeant major Langan of the Lancashire Fusiliers. They were all excellent. I mean, Humphreys knew stuff as from the point of view of the Royal Army Education Corps. Letchworth had been through Sandhurst, was a British officer. And in the event, Sergeant Major Langan was a great man. You had British regiments on the Indian establishment. Not all regiments of the British Army were on the Indian establishment. So the Lancashire Fusiliers was one of them. And Langan was the Sergeant Major, our company Sergeant Major. But they were all outstanding people. And in the sense that Major Humphreys then moved this element of the officers' training school eventually to Bangalore. When they were.
Now, did they have assisting them other British NCOs, or were the other more junior instructors, were they Indian NCOs or officers?
No, the actual weapons instructor for our company, weapons instructors were Indians, shall we say, Viceroy's commissioned officers or non-commissioned officers. The overall in charge of our training was Captain Letchworth of our company, and Sergeant Major Langan was the one who was in charge of our drill discipline and other disciplines.
How did you find the basic training? I mean, did you enjoy your time on basic training?
Yes, I enjoyed it. We had no difficulty. I personally had no difficulty about it.
Now, after 2 months, I think it was, you went to Bangalore.
Yes.
Now, how did that differ? That there you'd be joining the British cadets as well.
We moved as a company from Lahore to Bangalore, and there British cadets, conscripts, joined us. They had been either conscripted in India or conscripted in Britain.
Now, there was no segregation between the British and Indian cadets then? You were together?
Yes, we were together, competing together.
And what were you learning there? Could you take us through the elements of the course?
Well, we were learning, still continuing with drill, but we were learning, shall we say, fieldcraft tactics at platoon level.
Now, could you take us through some of the elements as it was then, if you remember? I mean, it's a long time ago, 60
No, years. I mean, we were, shall we say, taken out on, shall we say, outdoor exercises like defense or withdrawal or attack. But shall we say, if we would go out on defense, we would camp out. But this is where, shall we say, incidents would occur. Shall we say, another company of Indians, shall we say, platoon of Indians, because we were mixed companies, but in the sense it all depended at what time the British cadets were inducted. So this particular platoon, Indian platoon of another company, after digging the company commander, Major Hartley, felt that they had not dug enough. So when they were so-called manning their so-called defenses, he put his foot on an Indian cadet's bottom, whereas all civilians, they all resigned, en masse. So that kind of incident did occur, but not in our company.
So you were aware that this was going on, but it didn't happen in your company?
It didn't happen in our company, but it happened on the same exercise, but not in our company.
So essentially he was being disrespectful?
Well, I think what he would have done to a British other rank on the field firing range, shall we say, he did to an Indian cadet, but Indian cadets were more educated than, shall we say, the British conscripts would have had to put up with it if somebody had tried to put his foot in their bottom by saying, get your bum down or something like that. Well, possibly he was doing it for their own good.
So it wasn't so much a case of that he was being racist as that he was, that what he didn't realise was he was dealing with people who'd recently been civilians and weren't accustomed to, as opposed to a British conscript who'd already had a fair bit of basic training.
Yes, you could put it that way, but and particularly since these people, a lot of them were graduates of various categories, because the Indian educational system, Indians seem to place more emphasis on education than the generation of parents over here. I mean, comparatively, you will see in the league tables over here, it's not that I wish to carp, but you will see in the league tables of children over here, the Indians and the Chinese do the best of all the other categories. So I